Hello. This podcast is available unedited and ad-free at patreon.com/HamiltonMorris. Each month, I release 3 to 4 new podcasts, and it was Patreon exclusive until recently. Many people contacted me and said they wanted me to figure out a way to make it freely available, and so I decided to accept sponsorship from a few of my friends. One of them is David Rentlin, the founder of a company called Lucy Nicotine. They make nicotine gum, nicotine pouches, nicotine lozenges, some of which are made with synthetic nicotine, which I think is pretty cool. Now, if you don't already use nicotine, I recommend that you don't start. It's habit forming. But if you already do use nicotine products, and especially if you smoke tobacco cigarettes, I can say that this is a cleaner product. And it's also a product that I use personally. If you go to lucy.co and use the code Hamilton, you get 20% off your purchase. This podcast is also brought to you by MindCure, a Canadian life sciences company producing synthetic ibogaine that is also engaged in psychedelic research with MDMA. They're doing some cool work and I'm on their board of advisors. Lastly, this podcast is brought to you by Top Tree Herbs, an herbal tea company founded by my friend and pharmacopoeia producer, Soren Shade. This is not a traditional sponsorship in that I'm not receiving any money from them, but Soren is actually a producer on this podcast. They grow their own kratom domestically in Appalachia in a greenhouse, which is very beautiful, and they source leaves internationally, do third-party testing. I've been to the lab where they do the testing. They test for heavy metals and other adulterants, and it's ethically sourced in tea bag form. You can find their teas at toptreeherbs.com.
Okay, it looks like everybody is here.
Very cool. Hello, it's good to meet you.
Okay, Oliver, I'm asking you to unmute yourself. All right, very good. Okay. All right, so
hello there.
I am now recording. So for listeners who are not familiar with all of your work, could you all introduce yourselves, maybe starting with Brian?
Certainly. Brian Pearson, assistant professor at the University of Florida, located off campus at the Mid-Florida Research and Education Center. My area of expertise is plant cultivation, propagation, and growth. And my interest with this crop is to learn how to cultivate it, grow it, and to learn everything on the production side of things and about the plant side of things, how these unique alkaloids are produced by the plant.
Great. And Chris?
Yeah, hi, I'm Chris McCurdy. I'm a professor of medicinal chemistry and director of the University of Florida's Translational Drug Development Corps, obviously at the University of Florida. And I've been working on Mitragynia speciosa since about 2005, studying the alkaloids, isolating the alkaloids, really investigating the therapeutic potentials and anecdotal claims that have been made about this plant. And it was a long and arduous process in the beginning because there was no ways to get support. Interestingly enough, when we went to the National Institute on Drug Abuse, first, they had never heard of it. Second, they said, this is a natural product. Go to the National Institute on Complementary and Alternative Medicines. And when we went to them, they said, oh, it sounds like it's got opioid activity. Go to the National Institute on Drug Abuse. So we had a lot of difficulty trying to find funding. In the meantime, we had funding looking at Salvia divinorum. So that's a whole nother story. But we definitely plugged away on Mitragynia speciosa. And as time would have it and luck would have it, it became very prominent in society. And then the interest to fund the research was certainly there, and we were able to obtain funding. And we've been working on this for very intensely for the last few years.
Great. And Oliver Grundman, I think some listeners might be familiar with your work from our previous discussion, but maybe you could update anyone who didn't have the opportunity to hear that.
Sure, yeah. It's glad to be back. Hello there. My name is Oliver Grundman. I'm a clinical professor in the same department as Chris, Department of Medicinal Chemistry, although I'm located out of state in Arizona. I'm primarily involved in kratom from the perspective of use experiences and how people are using it, why they're using it, and getting a better understanding of what potential benefits and what potential cautionary advice should be given to those folks who are engaging with Kratom from a health care perspective, as well as from just a recreational user perspective as well.
Right. And I know that this isn't any of your specific areas of expertise. This is sort of a drug policy question, but I imagine many of you are familiar with the fact that the DEA is currently moving to place 5 psychedelics in Schedule 1 in about 1 week. And they have been doing this continuously for, you know, the better part of a century now. And it is something that most people don't really notice when it's happening. Last year, 40 drugs were placed in Schedule 1, and there was no public outcry. Most people didn't even know that it was happening. There was no opposition. And I think many people feel powerless. They don't know what they can do to stop this. And there are very few success stories, even in instances where people had a coordinated evidence-based effort to prevent the prohibition of a substance, they failed. A notable example would be Rick Doblin's attempts to prevent the prohibition of MDMA in 1986. So in this history, there are very, very few success stories. Really, the only one that I'm aware of is the work that was done with Kratom. So could you all tell me a little bit about how that happened, what was done in the scientific community and among users to prevent the prohibition of this plant, and what lessons can be learned from what happened with Kratom to better inform protests in the future to prevent the totally out of control prohibition of substances that are useful medicinally, useful to scientists, and to prevent people's freedoms from being encroached upon unnecessarily.
Yeah, I guess everybody's staying quiet to give me a crack at it first. So I think with the longest history of studying this plant and learning and watching the sort of grassroots effort by the users over the years just continually grow, and the advocacy for the plant and its use and its and I should say its appropriate use by those individuals for the intended purposes was really something that I don't think we've seen with too many other plants or substances prior to them being brought up for a regulatory action. And I think this was something that was very kind of unique and almost a perfect storm, because by the time we got to 2016, when the DEA first announced their intention to schedule Kratom, there was already a lot of work that had gone into studying the plant, not only by our lab, but other labs around the globe and in the United States as well. And interestingly enough, the National Institutes of Health had not really formally funded a grant on Kratom, but we had a grant at the University of Mississippi that was to investigate natural products for neuroscience. And the University of Mississippi also holds the only federal license to grow marijuana, as most people know. And so it was a great place for us to really be growing these plants and studying what could be happening and what was going on. But we were actually funded as a sub-project under that larger grant. And when DEA announced their intention, there was some discussions about NIH through program officers and our discussions that we had done some work and we wanted to provide that data to the NIH. And that data made it to the NIH. And I'm not sure what happened after that point. But certainly not too long after that point, there was an announcement that the DEA was going to sort of take questions or comments from the public, and they opened that 30-day comment period. There was a lot of pressures from many directions, from advocacy groups, from different types of advocacy groups around Kratom to really try and support it not going into illegal status. And then there was the research community that also was very much in favor of keeping it out of Schedule One because we wanted to see it studied further and really put science-based evidence behind a decision that was made in policy, which many times doesn't happen. And so I think exactly what you're saying, Hamilton, this is a very unique scenario where we got to see science have a little bit of an impact, but also we saw a tremendous amount of outpouring from advocates and users in this area that were stating how effective this has been at really changing their lives and putting those messages not only in front of DEA, but in front of our congressional leaders in the Senate, in the House of Representatives, and getting congressmen and senators behind supporting to keep this legal as well. And so I that's a long answer to a short question, but I think that's some of the uniqueness that we saw here, and maybe Oliver or Brian could add to that.
Yeah, I can certainly add from the user perspective. Back in 2016, I was not really involved with Kratom, but then in 2017, the first larger Kratom survey was conducted, and it resulted in really an outpouring of responses within a very brief period of time, which to me indicated how passionate Kratom users are about this plant and its benefits it has provided to them. Now, with self-select or self-select surveys like that, you obviously get some bias in them. But that being said, it has been reconfirmed over and over again now in at least four different surveys that followed subsequently that the benefits are definitely also supporting what Chris and others found in preclinical studies, that it benefits, it may be providing benefits in opioid use disorders, in certain other substance use disorders, but also is used by a large amount of folks just for its analgesic and its mood elevating properties. And I think that combined with just a really, like Chris said, a very well-established grassroots movement has really positioned Kratom uniquely within that space.
And the only thing I suppose add to that in my short time working with the plant is again echoing the level of involvement that the community has surrounding Kratom and their interest and knowledge about it. I don't think I've ever had a group as interested in reading manuscripts that we're putting out as perhaps the Kratom community, that when we publish something new about the plant, they are engaged in reading it, want to discuss it, want to talk about it further. Regular users that are very interested in reading the science and understanding more about the science. It's unique, I think, to this plant and that community.
Right. I mean, it's such an interesting area. One thing that I've noticed is that this is a very polarizing plant because it clearly helps an enormous number of people. But what I find, and I've known people who struggled with dependence on Kratom, and they would say, oh, well, everybody says that it's so much less habit forming than other drugs. And I think that there is quite a bit of evidence to support that. What I think was interesting about my friend who was struggling with dependence is that she was somebody who was drawn to the plant in the first place because of pre-existing substance abuse problems. This is somebody that had severe struggles with alcoholism and came from a family with a lot of opioid addiction and dependence. And so the very reason that she wanted to use this in the first place was because she was so susceptible to these problems and it seemed to represent a safer alternative. So it's sort of complicated. We talk about these things in a vacuum, like something is more or less prone to abuse, but there are certain plants or chemicals that are used specifically because the people who are drawn to them have a problem, right? Like there's probably, I think there is actually a surprising amount of tramadol abuse, and you'd think in many different countries, and one reason is not because tramadol has a greater abuse potential than fentanyl or something like that. I think most evidence would point to very much the opposite, but you have these regulatory issues where it was more available to people than some of the opioids that were considered more problematic in terms of dependence and abuse. And so you have all these other contributing factors that make it very hard to navigate the problems that people face with these substances, because you're dealing with the complicated interplay of pharmacology, but also society and the diverse types of people that are drawn to a given substance.
Yeah, and I think there's really important things in there that we're glossing over right now in research. I mean, we're not glossing over it intentionally. I think it's really difficult to do the deep dives that we want to do. And those deep dives are into understanding how genetics are involved. And you mentioned there was a genetic component to your friend. We know that genetically there are differences in metabolizing enzymes in various populations and various individuals. And we do know that certain metabolites in kratom can be more active or more abuse liable than other compounds that are present naturally in the plant. And I think we don't understand, we're not at a level of being able to really understand pharmacologically what's going on in humans yet. And especially in some of those populations that might be more at risk. But my gut feeling is that what we're seeing is differences in metabolic behaviors in certain individuals that are converting compounds into more potent compounds, or the genetic component elsewhere, you know, makeup of certain proteins or receptor levels in the brain that are changing. Kratom is a very complex natural product. Not that other natural products aren't complex, but you really have, and I always say that it's a symphony orchestra of alkaloids that have varying activities at many, many neurotransmitter levels. And so not only do we see opiate activity, we see adrenergic activity, we see serotonergic activity among some other targets. So you're getting this interplay of sort of positive reinforcement in many levels of the brain. And it may not be all opiate, it may not be all serotonergic, it may not be that. We understand what it is right now. And I think it's going to take us a lot more studies, even in animals, to try and start figuring this out. But certainly when we're able to get to controlled clinical trials in populations that we're talking about, people that have had substance use disorders, whether it be opiate, alcohol, methamphetamines, psychostimulants, we're not gonna start to really understand which populations this is going to be best in, and how can it be effectively monitored. And then you got to take that individual person and look at the individual makeup of the plant itself. And Brian can speak to this greater than I can, but we're seeing that there's various chemotypes of Mitragynia speciosa. So there's very analogous to what we see with cannabis sativa, where you have higher levels of mitragynin in some of these Mitragynia speciosa plants, and maybe non-existent levels of mitragynin, which is supposed to be the major alkaloid. And in some cases, we see it hardly there at all. So the analogy to the cannabis world is, of course, high THC producing plants to something like industrial hemp that would have no THC.
Right.
So it's complex.
Right. The pharmacogenomic aspect of it is really interesting, and it's amazing how many widely used opioids are prodrugs. I mean, I guess codeine is technically an opiate, but codeine, heroin, tramadol, and...
Yeah, tramadol. Perfect example.
Yeah, and mitragynine. I know that many of these have some degree of intrinsic activity, but they are, at the very least, have a more potent active metabolite.
I think one thing to also point out here is that we have not found evidence that anybody is trying to extract a single alkaloid like mitragynine from the plant and use that. So similar to, if you compare to opium or THC in cannabis, there have been no attempts to just isolate a single substance from the plant. Users are using the full plant material, the leaf material in most instances, or extracts of those leaves. And that indicates to me that, it might be an indication that it's really the full plant, as Chris already pointed out, that people are not after just one particular compound in it, and just one compound will not give them the same experience as ingestion of the leaf material.
Right. And why is that? Do you talk about the pharmacology of the different components, the different alkaloids, and what sort of role they play in the qualitative effects of Croton?
Yeah, I think that's still an unanswered question, largely unanswered. I mean, we know that the major alkaloids, the ones that we've been able to isolate so far to this point in time, we've isolated in our lab 15 of the alkaloids from the plant, and we've done full pharmacological characterization of those across central nervous system drug target panels. And what we can see is a very diverse pharmacological factory of alkaloids that are coming out of this plant. It's really amazing. And some compounds have opioid activity and some don't. But the ones that do have opioid activity have other pharmacologies associated with them as well. So they're not uniquely opioidergic as we would see from the opium poppy, where you get morphine and codeine. You're definitely seeing compounds that are polypharmacologic, or hitting many different receptor targets at the same time. And that carries through the entire class of alkaloids. And so some alkaloids may be tuning one of those receptor systems a little bit more directly than the others. In other words, a compound like corinthiazidine that's present in the plant is fairly alpha adrenergic in terms of its volume, if you will. Many of the other targets that it interacts with at a much lesser degree. So we call it affinity. It has a greater affinity for the alpha adrenergic system. Whereas compounds like speciogynin and panenthine have higher affinities towards serotonin receptors. Not to say that they're not interacting with all these other targets at the same time. And so we're seeing this interplay. And mitragynine, by the way, is not like opioid preferring. It actually binds to many of these other targets in micromolar to high nanomolar, hundreds of nanomolar ranges, which means that they're physiologically relevant at many of these targets. So not just opioid, which is what the whole story has been, that this is just another unregulated opioid. And yes, it is having opioid activity, but there's so much more to it. And I think that makes it so complex. And I almost look at it as that symphony orchestra. And now I'm thinking of it as a large mixing board where you're trying to understand which levers are pushed up and which ones are pulled back at which neurological targets. And then it's more complex than that, because these receptors can be presynaptic or postsynaptic and then have different effects in the nervous system depending on where they're located and how they're activated or inhibited. And so understanding how that whole plethora of pharmacology happens at once is really, really fun challenge from a science standpoint. And now we're to the point where we've isolated enough of these major alkaloids. We understand, at least in animal models, when you give a full Croton product, we know what compounds are reaching the blood supply and reaching the brain. And now we're trying to recreate those scenarios with the purified alkaloids in different levels to start seeing if we see different behavioral pharmacologies, if we see different issues starting to show up. And then we're also looking at what happens if we just completely remove one of those alkaloids, what happens behaviorally, and what happens, toxicology wise, all the different things we want to look at. So yeah, I wish there was an easy answer. There's not.
And what about the serotonergic activity? Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Yeah, so what we've seen so far is really activity at 5-HT 1A receptors. And we've also seen at 5-HT, I better get it right, 5-HT 2A receptors. So the actual anti-drug target that you would not want to activate, because this was the serotonergic target that causes valve issues in the heart if you activate it.
Are you sure you're not thinking
2B? I'm sorry?
Sure you're not thinking 2B?
2B, yeah, you're right, sorry. So 2B is the one that it's interacting with. They're not agonists of this receptor. In fact, they seem to be antagonists. And so we don't have to worry about the cardiovascular issues, at least associated to 5-HT2B receptors. The 5-HT1A receptor activity is interesting because it's been reported in the literature that 5-HT1A activity can be associated with decreasing opioid-induced respiratory depression. And so that from my head was like really fascinating, because this might be part of the mechanism as to why we don't see, respiratory depression issues with this. And it may be helping people that were on opioids be able to get off of them, have more energy, have more, they're not having any kind of respiratory depressive component. We've been looking at respiration studies, and those will be coming out in the future. I think the other piece of the serotonergic story, and we're really now doing a deep dive into all 14 serotonin receptors with all the alkaloids and some of the metabolites, because what we have noticed, and we published last year, is that speciogynin and phenanthine, the two alkaloids that seem to have the most serotonergic activity, their metabolites, what we would call O-dismethyl speciogynin and O-dismethyl phenanthine, have also pretty strong activity at 5-HT1A receptors. And so we're trying to see what all this means. We're trying to see how that works. We also know 5-HT1A is involved in mood. And so some of the mood elevating effects associated with Croton could be attributable to not only the parent compounds, which by the way, disappear pharmacokinetically in animals very quickly. And the metabolites seem to be much more longer lasting. And so it could be a combination of all these things, but that's the serotonin activity we've seen. We've looked at a couple of in vivo measures in rats to really understand if this is serotonergically mediated activity that we're seeing. And we can block the effects, the behavioral effects of 5-HT1A agonism with 5-HT1A antagonists. So we can pretty clearly, from a pharmacological standpoint, say that these effects are being mediated through that 5-HT system, specifically 5-HT1A, we believe. But it, like I said, we're doing a deep dive into all of these targets now to see.
That's really interesting. Yeah. And
So one thing to point out here is that what Chris just described is basically the pharmacology of individual alkaloids. And then when you look at what kind of products or variety of products that are out there with where we don't know necessarily what the composition is, what is the alkaloid concentration of speciogynin, phenanthine, chorinanthidine, all of these, I think it's important to then recognize that the product variability contributes to the observed variability and effects in users. And I think, Brian, you can talk a lot more about how this may be related to different cultivars too.
Certainly. Yeah, we see a wide array of, alkaloid concentrations when looking at the plant material that we've received. And so we have collected a good number of plants. I think we're near 1,000 Kratom trees at the current moment in our research center, and the variability from plant to plant can be quite large. We suspect a lot of this is genetics and the understanding of the scientific community about the diversity genetically that exists is really to the large part unknown, undocumented. And so we're getting into those, I guess, pieces now by looking at plants with certain alkaloidal distributions and then looking at the genetic makeup of those plants. Now they compare and contrast from the other plants that we have in our collection. But that begs the question, you know, when this product is going to market, how consistent is it? And for that user most times has no understanding of what is in that product when they're purchasing it. And so not only, as Chris said earlier, do you have a variability in human makeup and the metabolic processes after consumption, but even your starting point of the plant material is highly, highly variable, orders of magnitude apart. And so that further kind of complicates, if you will, the understanding of what is a common experience or a common reporting of the effects of consuming Kratom.
I'm curious how you form this collection of plants. What has been your process for collecting the different chemotypes?
Plant collectors largely. So the Kratom community, when we started the conversation, we said they're really active and really engaged. Quite a few members in the Kratom community want their own plants. They are fearful that they may not have access to this plant and its leaves for their own personal consumption. And so many of those members are willing volunteers to let me come and meet with them, chat with them, collect plant material, and even propagate trees from the trees in their collection. We've also had collectors that have imported plants from Southeast Asia that were willing to share material with us for research, so we also have a known latitude and longitude of origin for at least those plants. And then last but not least, seeds. We can purchase seeds and then germinate the seeds, although that's a bit more challenging as it's a sexual cross. So the variability that we get from that offspring is somewhat unknown, but again, it gives us some idea of what is out there and what the genetic potential is. And of course, the next iteration into the future of this and going into the program and looking into the crystal ball of the future, once we have an understanding of what is out there genetically, then it opens up the avenue for plant breeding. Are there certain attributes, certain qualities, certain alkaloids that we see that are preferential? And this is where this amazing collaboration comes in really handily, that we can work with our College of Pharmacy colleagues, and I'm in the College of Ag. So this allows me to have a great conversation with Oliver and Chris and say, okay, if these are attributes that are beneficial, let's move these forward through precision breeding programs to develop new crops for identifying certain needs. But yeah, most of them, I guess, to answer your question, came from collectors and really active community members.
We're so glad you're doing that. It's, you know, I think obviously the cannabis community has shown how much chemical diversity can come from a single species or from two species of a plant. And I haven't heard all that much about people doing the sort of work that you're doing. And I'm sure that if you continue it, you're going to find some really dramatically different chemotypes. I mean, and of course, in the sort of folk pharmacology that you encounter on forums and in the Kratom community, you hear people reporting all sorts of different effects, ranging from a predominantly sedative effect to one that's more stimulating in nature. Is there any chemical or pharmacological explanation for that that any of you have encountered?
That's exactly where we're trying to head out right now. I mean, that's the big question. Are we seeing, you know, there's long been a discussion of strain in the marketplace. And when we talk to vendors that are buying it from importers, they essentially buy from whatever batch of material is there. And somehow the strains seem to evolve as a marketing artifact, if you will. We are working with a farmer in Hawaii who claims to have a red vein and a green vein separate. We have not had boots on the ground or eyes to see confirmation of these, but we are receiving samples and testing those samples, and we do see differences in alkaloid content between those two trees. So there's definitely some sort of chemotype difference between those. I think what Brian's brought to the table in trying to bring this sort of repository, germ bank repository of every kind of chemotype we can get a hold of, it is really going to be powerful as we move forward in the research, because we can easily do analysis of 15 or more alkaloids and what their levels are in each of these plants, from a single plant to, you know, a whole field full of blended plants, and really start to understand not just mitragynine and 7-hydroxymitragynine, which is where everyone has been focused from day one, pretty much. And that makes sense. I mean, we all know natural products, usually the most abundant compound is the one that would give you the activity. I think the thing that blew me away, and I drank the Kool-Aid and was all in on this too, thinking that mitragynine was the major alkaloid in the tree, based on a Schellard paper from many, many years ago. And Brian, I think you should pick it up from here, because your observations and dissection of that study are important, I think, for the entire kratom, not only scientific community, but consumer community to understand.
Yeah, the paper, looking at the paper from a horticultural standpoint, there were very, very few replicates in that paper. And the plant material they did have appeared to be mixed with two different species of mitragynine. And so the paper took and extrapolated what a expected concentration and normal concentration of mitragynine would be, largely, and then making, extrapolating it to say that trees from Thailand or trees from Malaysia would have on average these percentages. But looking back at the data set of which they made that extrapolation on, it really wasn't appropriate. It was definitely overextending the reach, at least from the horticultural aspects of the paper. And it called into question, as we're starting to get samples in, what is a typical concentration? And so to this point, it was collecting this germplasm, trying to replicate so we could have perfect clones of these plants. And the major core of my work was to start to manipulate the environment. What happens when we change, you know, the temperature, the light levels, fertility, and how does the plant respond to this in terms of alkaloids, with the ultimate goal of understanding, one, the basic functioning of the plant, and two, it's sort of that extension component, the stakeholder outreach component, developing protocol for consistent production of plant material. And so one of the major goals for me with Kratom, other medicinal crops that we've worked with, to include cannabis sativa, industrial hemp, is one, how do we produce plants of a good quality? And then two, just as importantly, if not more so, having a consistent quality. So the product is as similar as possible, you know, time after time. But to kind of go back a little bit, the other major, I guess, benefit to having these trees in our possession that have this germplasm is looking at the plant not only as a live product, but also what happens after it's harvested, the post-harvest processes that occur with the plant. We know that consumption practices in Southeast Asia are very different than what we see in North America or Europe, where the leaves are harvested fresh, boiled fresh, consumed fresh. That is a very different product than what the average consumer here in the United States would have, where these plants were harvested weeks, months ago, dried, packaged, shipped. From that point of harvest to the point of consumption, it is a very different product potentially from what that fresh product would be. And so one, having this, again, genetics is good for a lot of different inquiries that we're interested to understand, but it also opens the avenue to understand what this difference in consumptive practice might mean relative to consumers that consume this traditionally in Southeast Asia.
I'm going to pause momentarily for an ad. This podcast is brought to you by Matcha Kari, matcha.com. This is Andrew Weil's Matcha Tea Company. Andrew Weil is one of the pioneers of the study of psychedelic drugs, and he now owns a matcha tea company that sells imported matcha that's tested for heavy metals. If you go to matcha.com, you can see the analysis of all of their teas. I drink it almost every day. It is delicious matcha. If you go to matcha.com and use the discount code Hamilton, you get 10% off any teas that you buy. Thank you, matcha.com.
Right, and I think most people will be familiar with how this impacts the chemistry of cannabis. You have some cannabinoids that are somewhat unstable. THC will gradually convert to CBN. What sorts of differences are possible with the either the degradation or other sorts of changes that can occur with kratom? I mean, I'm very interested in the possibility that certain types of storage or processing could increase the concentration of 7-hydroxymetragine. Is that something that you have looked at all?
That's really the focal point of our interest. And this really comes from the standpoint that when we harvest leaves of the tree, we're not seeing 7-hydroxymetragine present. And so that begs the question, why are we not seeing it? And so to answer that question requires getting a certain amount of plant mass of biomass of known concentrations. And that's kind of where we're at the moment to better understand that relationship. But yeah, 7-hydroxymetragine is certainly a focal area of ours and trying to understand, is it being produced from certain techniques or certain reactions that are occurring post-harvest? And Chris, you might want to add more to that than just that. I know that's also an area of interest that we share.
Yeah, I think one of the largest questions that we had back in 2016, ironically enough, the same year that the DEA put their actions out, we published a paper that we had been working on for years up to that, looking at potential, what we thought was potential adulteration of commercial kratom products, because we were seeing 7-hydroxy concentrations from very low levels to maybe 1% of the entire product to 500 times that level. And so we had products that we were purchasing in the marketplace that were just all over the place. And what we saw consistently was when mitragynin levels were high, 7-hydroxy were relatively low. And as 7-hydroxy levels went up, mitragynin levels went proportionally down. And so whether it's a direct one-to-one conversion, I can't tell you. But what we initially thought is that people were actually adding 7-hydroxy somehow. As we started to get more and more into the chemistry, we realized that that's probably not happening, because you would have to isolate a heck of a lot of mitragynin pure and then convert it through a very poor yielding chemical reaction to the 7-hydroxy, purified, and then put it back in. So we really think it's a post-harvest artifact. And that's been underscored not only by the plant material we have here at the university with Brian, but it's been underscored in products that we've acquired for analysis in Malaysia from fresh producers, freshly brewed tea. We've also been working with the University of Sains Malaysia, where they have direct access to farms, and they go in and we've GPS marked certain trees that we've harvested from, and we've profiled those trees. And in fact, we found different chemotypes of trees on these plantations that are traditionally used. Some that had very, very little to no detectable mitragynin levels, and others that had very high. But we never once saw 7-hydroxy present in any of those. We were contacted by a now collaborator, Sarah O'Connor, who's at the Max Planck Institute in Germany, and one of the world's leading biosynthetic alkaloid biosynthetic plant people, and her work has really been at trying to elucidate the biosynthetic pathways and mechanisms that generate the different kratom alkaloids and what enzymes are necessary, what genes are contributing to all that process. And we've been able to have a really nice working relationship where we've provided them with standards so that they could for sure know what compounds they're seeing generated through enzymatic processes. But they have yet to find, and I haven't talked to her for a few months, but they have yet to find an enzyme that converts mitragynine into 7-hydroxymitragynine in the plant material. And so we really believe it's post-harvest. Now, getting back to your earlier question, what happens post-harvest? And that's where we're really just about teed up with Brian and our ability to do the analysis to see, what's happening, what conditions are causing this. And I do want to make one more comment on this while we're on it. That report that we published in 2016, where we saw this variability in the marketplace all over the place with 7-hydroxy levels. I don't know if that paper and some of the work that we've done and others have done have really influenced the marketplace and really driven a conscious effort to drive 7-hydroxy concentrations down. But most of the products that we purchase now and analyze from, either the internet or were provided by vendors or we get in other available places right here in Gainesville, they don't have detectable levels of 7-hydroxy in them anymore. And I feel like this is a huge advancement for the products that are out there in the marketplace, because we don't know what the risk of 7-hydroxy is. We don't know what level impacts a risk to humans either. But we do know that 7-hydroxy has abuse potential and is much more similar to a pure opioid-like compound than any of the other alkaloids we've seen out of the plant that the plant has produced. And so what we've seen is a disproportionate increase in users and no real increase in poison control center and harm. Do you know what I'm getting at? Whereas back in 2016, we may have had X amount of users and there was X amount of associated poison control calls and incidents of harm. And the quality of the product in the marketplace probably wasn't as good. I think the quality has been getting better. I'm not saying that it's safe and by any means effective in terms of just go out and get anything. But I truly believe that the products are getting less 7-hydroxy in them, and that could be driving less harm. And that's at least our theory. So we'll just have to see.
And if I heard you correctly, you said that you observed a 500 times more in one sample.
Yeah.
And how could that, what's your explanation for how that could be the case?
We really don't know. We did find a lot of procedures on the in different places on the internet on how to sort of increase your 7-hydroxy levels by yourself. And we investigated many of those. Some of them were sort of baking it in the oven to increase it. Some of those were adding chemical oxidants, which some people said were, inert chemical oxidants. I can tell you firsthand that some of the oxidants that were used are by no means inert to our system. And so when they're dumping these chemical oxidants in with the entire plant material, not only are they converting mitragynine to 7-hydroxy, but they're converting every other compound in there to some other oxidized species. And we know that our bodies don't like oxidized things. That's why antioxidants are so popular, and particularly a lot of natural products are used for their antioxidant properties. And so I think that, all of these things could have been causing problems. We don't know why the levels were as high as they were in some of those products. And again, I think that's something, like Brian said, we're very interested in trying to understand what conditions caused these for a few reasons. One, we want to know. It's not that we want to publish and let people know. We want to understand it better so that we might be able to inform production of products in the future as to how it could be avoided or other safe chemicals that we could put in there to help avoid that oxidative step. But that's kind of what we're thinking these days.
What sort of oxidizing agents were people using, like potassium permanganate or hydrogen peroxide?
Exactly. Potassium permanganate and hydrogen peroxide. And I can tell you firsthand, literally firsthand, when I was a postdoc, I was working on oxidants of opioid molecules, as a matter of fact, of naltrexone, and was doing oxidation reaction with potassium permanganate. And I was forming my own oxidizing complex, so it was more reactive. And I did one of the dumbest things a chemist could do, and that is sit down at my desk with my gloves still on. And I leaned over, put my fingers on my forehead to read a paper. And it didn't burn me or feel weird. I got very little on my skin, but I had two purple dots on my forehead for a very long time because the oxidation of my skin took place. Luckily, it reversed at some point. But that was a good reminder to show you. And if it can do that just topically, you can imagine if you're ingesting potassium permanganate, which if you look it up on Wikipedia, it says it's chemically inert. And it's like, oh, no, people, please don't do these types of things.
That's a bad idea. Wow, that's interesting. And Brian, I never had the opportunity to go to Malaysia or Indonesia. I only went to Thailand to observe the practices there. But what I saw was there were people that used wild plants, and there were a small number of people that had a tree in their backyard, but it didn't seem like anybody was selectively breeding them in the way that you encounter with cannabis or tobacco or something like that. It seemed that there was actually very little or no attention paid to, I don't want to say the genetics, because that would not be factored in, but even to selective breeding in any way. But I'm curious, from an agricultural perspective, if that's different in Malaysia or Indonesia, or these places where this has become an enormous cash crop. Are people doing selective breeding? Are they actively investigating new strains that have different characteristics, or is it sort of a larger scale version of what I observed in Thailand?
I would say historically in the last, since really in the 50s, essentially, what you observed, I think that was the majority of the cultivation practice. What's happening now in Thailand, as kratom is now being recognized as a medicinal crop, where they are undergoing a change, I guess, in their agricultural practices, similar to what we're observing in cannabis sativa. Now, as restrictions are coming off of working with this plant, doing research with this plant, they're going off. And so I'm working with a colleague now in Thailand who is going off and trying to document what the alkaloid concentrations and profiles are in wild plants and what diversity is actually out there, what is being cultivated in one's backyard. I think for a large time in history, and again, since essentially the 50s, the people that were selecting plants either from the wild or cultivating trees in their backyard were doing it from taking a few leaves from the tree and saying, hey, this is a good one. This one is having the reaction or the benefit I want, and moving that forward. Again, not very dissimilar from the cannabis sativa in the way that that has worked under prior restrictions. Interestingly, there was a paper about a year and a half ago that went around, and users of wild kratom went with researchers to select leaves from a population of plants, regular users, and identifying the good plants. Only 36% of the plants that were sampled actually had mitragynine, in them, in the leaves. So again, that kind of begs that question. If regular users are reporting medical efficacy from consumption of these leaves, yet only 36% of all the leaves, trees sampled actually contain mitragynine, then what other alkaloid or alkaloids are being present that are having these reported medical benefits? But I guess, again, not to go too far down that rabbit hole, back to your question, I'm not aware of other institutions that are doing that work other than Thailand right now, going through this sort of revolution of looking at it as a medicinal crop and trying to bring science to identifying good genetics. And similar to many other crops that have come through and since have established industries around them, that first step is, what do we have out there? What is genetically available? And then starting to make improvements based on our objective goals.
I think it'd be interesting. Malaysia is pretty much the same way that you described in Thailand from the experiences I had in Malaysia. Almost every rural house has a tree in their yard, in their backyard, that they can use legally for consumption. There are some off the beaten paths, and I mean literally, we had to crawl through some stuff to get back into some of these farms, they're pretty amazing. I mean, the trees are interspersed with all kinds of other trees and things, so they don't look, it doesn't look like a agricultural setup that we would think of here in the U.S. So to think that they're putting anything more into it than just, hey, this is the tree, this is the right stuff, let's just go for it, I think isn't there. I want to just touch on one more thing about the traditional use before we jump onto another topic, and that is something that I've heard people describe with fresh leaf that I've never heard described with products that are available in the U.S. And that's when they chew a fresh leaf or drink a tea brewed with a fresh leaf, there's a numbing sensation that happens in the mouth. And when you utilize the products, either make tea with dried leaf material here, or you utilize capsules or extracts, they don't generally get that numbing sensation. And I've talked to a lot of people who have used it, but they've said they've never felt that. And I think what's even more interesting is that I ask, because these products are available on a daily basis, fresh brewed in Malaysia, and I ask them, how long do these last? How long is the efficacy? And people would say that after about 48 hours, the tea is no longer good. So they won't consume it past 48 hours. Interestingly enough, we've had tea samples that are much older than 48 hours, and the alkaloid levels don't change. So it could be that we're chasing the wrong beast altogether, and there's some other compounds in there more similar to terpenes like we see in cannabis that are what are paired with the sort of, this is the effect we're looking for. And I can't help but get out of my head, it just anecdotally, that numbing sensation in the mouth may be what's giving these individuals in the traditional sense, this is what we want, this is what we know this should feel like or be like. And if it lasts for 24 hours after they consume that, that's another story. So I don't know. I think there's a lot that we still don't even understand about the differences between traditional use product versus what we're seeing used on a regular basis in the Western Hemisphere.
And then link that together with what you mentioned earlier, Chris, about Poison Control Center calls. In almost none of these instances did we actually know what was the Kratom product that was consumed. What was the composition of these Kratom products? That even applies to the fatalities that have been documented by FDA. In most cases, we do not know what kind of product has been consumed. And for the fatalities, we have discussed this before and addressed it, that it's primarily a polysubstance situation, where then when you combine that with what you mentioned in terms of pharmacogenomics or the enzymatic influence of kratom consumption on enzyme activities, on metabolism of other compounds that are taken together, that presents another complex topic to it in itself, I think.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I would love it to be the case that more people could use the fresh leaves the way it is done in Thailand. I think that, although I'm a chemist and I'm not at all opposed to people using isolated chemicals, it's what I think about all day. But I think that there is some validity to this idea that people that are consuming whole plants, especially if they have some connection to the plant itself, they tend to not get into the same types of problems. I mean, in the same way that you don't hear about opium overdoses the way you do hear about morphine overdoses, and you don't hear about problems with people chewing coca leaves in the same way that you do with people snorting cocaine. And I think it would be really nice for users in the United States to have access to that fresh leaf, but it seems that there's just no domestic market for it. I mean, at least historically, I thought there was a belief that it couldn't even be cultivated in the United States, but it seems that that is not the case.
Yeah, in fact, it's kind of funny. Early on when we started some of the internet, you know, myths and rumors, and I thought I was going to be faced with a really significant challenge hearing that the seeds won't germinate 12 hours after they hit the ground and things like that. And as we've tested some of them, we've eliminated a lot of these myths. And that one in particular is most certainly not true. We've germinated seed that is over 2 years old. So we have well beyond that 12-hour mark to work with. But going back to domestic cultivation, taking on and growing a new crop, there's a lot of different challenges and worries and concerns that come from agricultural producers. One, you know, where do we get the plants? Are they good plants and of good quality? That is a challenge. Where can we produce these? What soils? And this is a tropical plant. How cold hardy are these? And how are there more cold tolerant species amongst the trees that we can import or propagate here in the U.S.? We do know of domestic production in Hawaii. I am aware of domestic cultivation on small acreage and here in Florida. Observing these plants for the last several years, more northerly climates, North Florida and beyond, is probably a stretch given the cold temperatures and the sensitivity around freezing condition that these trees exhibit. And then for the grower, let's say they do say, I want to grow this, I can grow this tree. Then comes in the question, the future legality of it. If I end up cultivating several thousand acres or 100 acres and it becomes a Schedule I substance, what does that mean for the future of my farm and my investment in that farm? And so when you kind of mix this together, I think there was a lot of faith that was going to have to be placed on the producer to accept all of this and to overcome these challenges and unknowns. And I guess not dissimilar from the description of a tree or two in the backyard in a house in Malaysia or Thailand, I have visited several far homes that we see something similar to that, where users want one or two trees and they tend to them in their yard. But domestic production is possible, most certainly, and we're seeing increase in acreage, at least here in Florida, amongst a few growers I'm working with.
That's exciting.
I think it's interesting. I mean, the farmers are really obviously engaged and interested, and so is the Kratom community. I think consumers are happy to have a knowledge of where these plants are being produced, how they're being produced, what practices are in place in the handling and the post-harvest. And so it kind of sheds light onto the quality of the product and the handling. Again, sort of analogous to the way that cannabis has manifested as an industry over the last decade or so. And bringing some industry standards to that here in the U.S., I think comforts some users.
Yeah, and I'll just add to that. I mean, obviously, I cannot speak for or do not speak for the FDA, but having a known traceable substance that can be regulated from seed to consumer, I think is a much more attractive plan than having a pile of dried leaves show up somewhere at a port that you really have no idea what they've been exposed to, where they came from, and what the history is. You know, that will go a long way in terms of regulatory space for product safety.
Right, and I think that I heard that we might have to end this in an hour. So just as a quick closing remarks, for people that are interested in this world, how can they, you know, what can they expect in the future from the work you're all doing? How can they contribute? What can they do to help keep this science ongoing and ideally prevent the prohibition of this plant? And it's a broad question, but I know a lot of people care about this and they want to be involved and they don't know what they can do to help.
I think, you know, one of the best things to do is there's an incredible lack of knowledge in the medical community. Patients are a lot of people who are using Kratom are afraid to discuss it with their healthcare providers for fear that there could be, you know, some sort of alienation or repercussion or whatnot with that. Oliver and I actually just published a op-ed piece this past weekend in the Tampa Bay Times to sort of highlight the fact that the medical community needs more education. We're trying to support legislation that's being put forward to regulate Kratom products for the Kratom Consumer Protection Act. We feel that this is a necessary and needed step forward, because not only does it protect consumers, but it starts to alert the medical community that this is something that obviously is elevated to the point of legislative action in a positive way. So let's now figure out how we can have that conversation with the medical community, enhance knowledge, increase knowledge, and not shy away from all the science. I mean, you know, we all want to hear about only the positive, but there are some things that have to be told that maybe people don't want to hear. And you can't just ignore the truth of what the science is presenting to us. Perfect example of that is a study we're doing right now, where many mothers that are opioid users may switch over when they find out that they're pregnant to something like Kratom, because they think it's a natural product and it's safe, and it can carry them through without being detected or being problematic in drug screens. And is it really safe to the fetus? Is it really safe to the developing baby? So we're opening up and looking at studies of exposure in rats to fetus and looking at the offspring pups to see what the behaviors are, to really understand, is it a safe alternative or is it not? And, you know, if it turns out to not be, that's an important piece of public health information that needs to be out there, so people can understand that it isn't safe. If it is safe, then it is safe, and we'll obviously try to spread that word too. But you know, you got to take the good with the bad, unfortunately, in a lot of these things. And I think now that we know that there's some legitimacy behind some of the straight up pharmacological claims, at least in animal models, we're moving into human clinical trials. There are a couple of human clinical trials ongoing right now. There's one in Canada that's ongoing, and there's one at Washington State University that's been going on, looking at sort of a herb drug interaction type study of pharmacokinetics. But that'll be one of the first ones published in humans. And then we need to go and look at more and more human studies. And now that we've gotten to that point, it's going to be really, really important for us to see and establish that safety, and then hopefully follow through with efficacy in certain areas. And I think that's where we're going. And then, you know, with Brian's work, it's sort of the sky's the limit, because being able to look at these at a genetic level, we have some other talented faculty in our Institute for Food and Agricultural Sciences that we're working with that can really start to interrogate the genome of Mitragynia speciosa and look at things down to the protein level. And can we change, and modulate the production of alkaloids to really get rid of anything that we find out is problematic, or enhance expression of other things. And so right now it's kind of like, we've always said we're in the infancy of Kratom research, but we're finally to the point where we can get to the infancy of human research with Kratom, and then we can actually get to really understanding the plant itself now. And so I think in the next 5 years, maybe 10 years, we're going to understand exponentially more from not only the human scientific side of this, but from the horticultural and cultivative side of the plant itself. So I think it's just, you know, I always hate to say we're in the infancy, because gosh, we've been at it for years and years and years. But I think there's a lot of exciting things to come forward, and there's a lot of important information that we have to get out to the public.
Any other final remarks?
Well, I wholeheartedly agree that we have some exciting research yet to be done on Kratom. And I think from the user experience side, we see really the differential use of Kratom emerging for different indications or for different self-treatments. And pulling that further apart is currently something that we are all very much interested in. Chris and I, with other collaborators, are working on that from both a survey approach and also from direct questionnaire interrogations. And I think it will really bring nicely together the human clinical trial site, controlled clinical trials with user experiences, because we have between 5 to 15 million Kratom users in the United States. That's kind of the estimated range. So that already gives us a lot of knowledge of what users are experiencing in the United States and in other parts of the world as well. So I think there is really some important and interesting information that can serve the medical community and users alike.
I guess from my perspective, you know, over the next several years, what I see coming forward is we see an expansion already of domestic production, working with a grower in the Tampa Bay area. We saw first time that I'm aware of domestically produced Kratom, at least on the mainland, being available in Kava and Kratom bars to consumers and customers. So they're getting this farm to kind of pharmacy approach that has already established itself in Florida in fall of 2021. We're going to see an expansion of that, at least here in our state, throughout 2022. And as our collaborators in Thailand expand their programs, I'm really excited to see what they find regarding some of the genetic diversity that's present naturally in natural places. Just to give us a better scope of understanding of what is actually out there and what is not, and what selection may have occurred from the growers that have exported materials, primarily, I guess, in Indonesia, what is being moved forward? And that would help answer a lot of questions that we've asked ourselves looking at these products over the years.
I guess one last thing, just to, you know, people always, I'm continually getting emails, as I'm sure Brian and Oliver do as well, from users. The majority of them are, what can I do to help with the research? And really, you know, I wish we could take everyone that emails us and put them into a clinical trial or get samples from them, but there's so many regulatory issues to go through to do that. What I would say is, if they have the opportunity to share their experiences, positive or negative, with their healthcare providers, I think it's just a great opportunity to help us at least start to reach those individuals that are going to help us. Because the fact of the matter is the only thing that healthcare providers and really physicians are seeing are the case studies that end up getting reported in the medical literature, which are all negative. And they're not seeing the real positive studies, and they're definitely not reading the preclinical journals to find out about some new obscure natural product that they may or may never see in their practice. So just education is key here. I think that's what all of us in the academic circles would say, but in this case, I think it's really important for not only the medical community, but also the legislative community. So
thank you all so much for your time and your research. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, I'll put this up this week. And if you all want to send me anything, any work you want me to link, or send it to Soren and he'll forward it to me. And I'll let you all know when it goes up on YouTube.
Great, thanks.
Thank you so much.
We need to connect up with Soren again too, because we analyzed his trees. So.
Yes. All right. Well, thanks again. Have a good day, everybody.
Thank you. You too. Bye.